My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. In 1970, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin composed The Immigrant Song. The lyrics said, in part, "We come from the land of the ice and snow, from the midnight sun where the hot springs flow, the hammer of the gods. We'll drive our ships to new lands, to fight the horde and sing and cry, Valhalla, I am coming." References to Norse mythology may once again be found in mainstream pop culture. Marvel Studios' blockbuster series of movies featuring Odin, Thor, and Loki are drawing record crowds to connect with the energy that they represent. Why is there this resurgent interest in the mystic North and the neo-pagans finding new meaning in ancient beliefs and practices? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, author and historian Christopher McIntosh, says these ancient roots are resonating again today. Christopher McIntosh is the author of numerous books on various esoteric traditions. He holds a PhD in history from Oxford, a degree in German from London University, and a diploma in Russian from the United Nations Language School. He was on the faculty of the Center for the Study of Esotericism at Exeter University. He lives in Germany, from where he is joining me this week to discuss his new book, Beyond the North Wind, The Fall and Rise of the Mystic North. Please join me in welcoming to Destination Unlimited, Christopher McIntosh. Good evening, Chris.
Good evening, Victor. A pleasure to be on your show.
And Christopher, please share with our listeners about your early path and how it led to your fascination with both history and the esoteric traditions.
Well, when I was a student at Oxford, back in the 1960s, I had a friend who was interested in astrology, and he got me interested in astrology, and I started experimenting, casting horoscopes and so on, and reading books about astrology. And after I left university, I decided to write a book about astrology, which was my first book. It was called The Astrologers and Their Creed, which was a history of astrology from the earliest times up to the present day. And through writing that book, I came into contact with the whole world of the Western esoteric traditions. And one of the things that I came into contact with at that time was Rosicrucianism, the Rosicrucian tradition. And I became very intrigued by that as well. So I then wrote a book called the Rosicrucians. In between the astrology book and the Rosicrucians, I wrote a book about the French magician Eliphas Lévy. So at that time, I was living in London, and I got to know, backtrack a bit. I moved to London around 1978, and I had a circle of friends in London, one of whom was Freya Aswin, who was very interested in the runes and has since become very famous as an expert on the runes, and has written an excellent book called The Leaves of Yggdrasil about the runes. So through her, I also became interested in the runes. And around a little bit later on, I also got to know Hilmar Ern Hilmarsson, who wrote the foreword to my book, Beyond the North Wind. He is now head of the pagan community in Iceland, the Asatru Fellowship, and also well known as a composer. So I gradually became more and more interested in this Nordic tradition. And I think a key turning point for me was when I was living in the States I spent 4 years living in New York, New York City, from 1989 to 1993, working for the United Nations. Well, sometimes one has to look back at the place one comes from to realize that's where one belongs. So looking back across the Atlantic at Europe, I realized that I'm a North European. That's where my roots are. So when I moved back to Europe, first back to London and then to Germany, I began to study the whole Nordic tradition more in greater depth. I very soon discovered what a rich and fascinating world it is. It's a world that is close to my heart because it is my own. That's where my own roots are as a Northern European. So that's more or less in a nutshell how I came to this area.
Now, we are both from the same generation, and as you share in your materials, when we were growing up in the 50s and 60s, the educational and cultural emphasis was on Greek and Roman mythology, and that not that of the North. To what do you attribute the modern resurgence of interest in Norse mythology?
Well, as you say, when you and I were growing up, what we taught about was, apart from the biblical narrative, it was the gods of ancient Greece and Rome. So I could very easily have said who Jupiter and Mercury and Venus were, but I would have been hard put to it to say anything about, say, Thor or Odin or Freya. Well, now, as you say, that's changed, and there is this resurgence going on. I think there are a number of reasons for it. One thing that I talk about in my book is the notion of a northern egregore. What I mean by an egregore is a collective thought form on the inner plane or the etheric plane created by many people thinking the same thoughts and focusing on the same ideas and symbols. And I think it's possible to speak of something that one might call a northern egregore, which was at some point submerged and suppressed, but lived on sort of underground, semi-dormant, but in recent years has come to the surface again and been revived. And I think that's what we're seeing in this resurgence. I think it has something to do with the fact that Christianity has lost its monopoly over the spiritual life, at least in Europe and the West, and that people are looking around for alternatives. Some people are looking to New Age things like anthroposophy and so on. Others are looking for something that's closer to their roots. And I think that if you're from Northern Europe, as I am, it's natural to turn to something like this Nordic tradition.
As was the case with Greek and Roman gods and goddesses, the Nordic pantheon had deities representing all aspects of life, reflecting very much the personalities of the culture that spawned it and explaining what was happening in both nature and civilization. What was the foundation story of the Norse gods and goddesses?
You could say the main feature of the story is that it's a cyclical story. This is what distinguishes the Nordic mythology, and in fact, all pagan mythologies from the monotheistic narrative, which is linear. In the monotheistic narrative, everything goes in a straight line, whereas in the Nordic tradition and other similar traditions, it all goes in a great circle. The world comes into being. The gods and humans live in harmony. There's a golden age. And then there comes conflict, disintegration. The world goes up in smoke. And then it all starts again with a rebirth and the whole circle starts again.
I'm sorry. Is that something that we can look at in terms of the belief and the archaeological findings that there were prior civilizations that were destroyed by calamity, natural disaster, and then resurgent?
Yes. We don't have any direct evidence for this, but there's quite a lot of indirect evidence in the form of archaeological remains, like, for example, the great megalithic monuments like Stonehenge and the Callanish stones in the Hebrides, and also certain remains that have been found in Russia, and things of that sort.
And the underwater structures found off of Bimini here in the Atlantic.
Yes. Well, I'm not familiar with those, but probably they come into the same category, yes.
My guest this week on Destination Unlimited is Christopher McIntosh. He's the author of Beyond the North Wind, The Fall and Rise of the Mystic North. And we'll be back with more of Chris after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Tune in to the Practical Intuitive, Mind, Body, Spirit for the Real World with me, host Robin Fritz, Mondays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 Eastern. I'll cover personal and business intuition, animal communication, mediumship, space clearing, past life regression, shamanic insights, energy healing, soul choice, and more, all to help you tap your own intuitive and healing skills. No ifs, ands, or buts.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up. Like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What Is Going On? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Christopher McIntosh. He's the author of Beyond the North Wind, The Fall and Rise of the Mystic North. Chris, where did the stories of Hyperborea start geographically, and how did they spread?
Well, it all started with an ancient Greek mariner called Pythias, who, in about the 4th century BC, set out from the port of Massalia, which is present-day Marseille, and he sailed out of the Mediterranean through the Pillars of Hercules, i.e. the Strait of Gibraltar, and into the far north, and he eventually reached a land which he described as a land of fog and ice, which may have been Iceland, we don't know. But he called it Thule or Thule, and the Romans later called it Ultima Thule. And this merged with a Greek legend about a land in the far north called Hyperborea. Hyperborea, the land beyond Boreas, the north wind. And this was said to be a warm, fertile place, right in the far north, but having a warm climate, a fertile place, where which was home to an advanced civilization. And this this idea of Hyperborea was handed down over the centuries. All kinds of people wrote about it. Greek writers, Roman writers, medieval writers, and right up to the present day. So it was like a snowball that kept rolling and gathering more and more layers. And it's still going.
Is there any evidence linking Hyperborea to Atlantis?
Well, some people think there is. It's difficult to say one way or the other because we don't know where Atlantis was located. Plato just says that it was somewhere out in the Atlantic. It could have been in the North Atlantic. We don't know. There was one Swedish writer, Rudbeck, who was convinced that Atlantis and Hyperborea were the same, and he was convinced that that Sweden was in fact Hyperborea. But there've been a lot of people who've tried to sort of appropriate the Hyperborean idea and apply it to their own region, and that's one example.
And it is said that the people of Hyperborea were described as giants. Why?
As giants? Well, I was not aware that they were described as giants. Where does that description occur?
I had read something to the effect that the people coming from that area from the north were described as giants. And I'm wondering if it refers not necessarily to people of giant size, but perhaps giant capability, people who were able to travel the oceans, etc.
That's possible, yes. Yes.
Now, many of us do not realize that in speaking some of the days of the week, we're actually expressing the names of Norse deities. What are those days?
Right. Well, Tuesday is named after the god Tyr, the Nordic god Tyr, who really is a kind of symbol of self-sacrifice, because there's a monster called the Fenris Wolf who's going to be one of the monsters that destroy the world at the end of the world, and he's going to devour the god Odin. So they need to tie this Fenris Wolf and fetter him. And they managed to do this by Tyr putting his right hand into the mouth of the wolf while he's being fettered. And the wolf, in revenge, bites his hand off. So that's Tyr. Then there is Wednesday, which is named after Woden or Odin. Then there is Thursday, which is named after Thor, the thunder god. And Friday, which is named after the goddess Freya, who's the Nordic goddess of love. So it's those 4 days.
So in essence, every time we're referring to one of those days, we're referring to a Norse deity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
I wonder how many people are not aware of that. That's really amazing.
I think not that many.
Now, do you have any personal favorites among the Norse pantheon?
Yes, I think if I have a favorite, it would be Odin, because Odin is the god of eloquence and poetry and communication and wisdom. And Well, as a writer, those qualities are important for me. The Romans identified Odin with Mercury, who is also a god of communication and speech and so on. For those reasons, I would say I think Odin is probably my favorite.
As identifying Odin with Mercury, is that part of the Hermetic tradition?
No, not really. Not really. I think it's the Hermetic thing is really a separate tradition.
Mm-hmm. Is there any member of the Norse pantheon who you dislike strongly?
Well, the villain of the pantheon is Loki. Loki is the trickster god, the evildoer, who gets up to all sorts of unpleasant things. In a way, he's a sort of ambivalent god, because if it weren't for Loki, nothing would move forward. So he's sort of like he's sort of like the grain of sand in the oyster, you know, that produces the pearl. But he has parallels in many other pantheons. He's in a way has some similarities to the Christian devil. And to, for example, the figure of Set in the Egyptian mythology, and various other figures. Many mythologies have a trickster figure.
One of the gods that I was not familiar with until reading your book was Baldur. Is that pronounced right? Baldur, is that correct?
Yeah, Baldur or Balder.
Or Balder. And the most and he was described as the most beautiful of the gods, the god of light. Please share with our listeners about Baldur.
Well, Baldur is, as you say, he's a light figure. He's a radiant god. And he was the most loved of all the gods. Everyone loved him. He had no enemies. He was just pure light and radiance. And his mother, when he was born, his mother went to everyone and everything in the world and made them promise not to do Baldur any harm. And so she, for example, she went to all the plants, but the one plant that she forgot to go to was the mistletoe. And this proved to be fateful because at one point, the gods are holding an archery competition, and Baldur has offered himself as the target because he can't be harmed. You see, nothing can harm him. So when the arrows hit him, he remains uninjured. But Loki comes along, and one of the people shooting arrows at Baldur is the blind god Hodur. And so Loki makes an arrow out of mistletoe and gives it to Hodur. And he guides Hodur's aim. And Hodur lets fly the arrow at Baldur, and Baldur is killed. So that's the story of Baldur.
And what happens to the whole pantheon after the death of Baldur, to that whole existence?
Well, it's just a very sad occasion. And Baldur is the son of Odin, and Odin punishes Loki by locking him up underground and having a serpent drip poison onto him. So that's really how the story ends. But Loki's wife stands beside him and catches the poison in a chalice. Mm. So some bloodthirsty things go on in the in the Nordic mythology.
Absolutely. Not to use a bad pun, but I'm a punster, so I must. Someone asked me what I thought of Tom Huddleston's portrayal in the movies, the Marvel movies, and I thought, well, his performance was rather low-key, but that's another story for another time. Yes. My guest this week on Destination Unlimited is Christopher McIntosh. He's the author of Beyond the North Wind, of the Fall and Rise of the Mystic North. Chris, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and your work.
Right. Well, the book is easy to obtain. It's published by Wiser Books, and you can get it from Amazon or from any internet bookseller or from many regular book outlets. To find out more about me and my work, the best thing is to look at my website, which is www.ozgard, that's spelled ozgard.net. www.ozgard.net.
And you're going to find when you go to his site and check him out on the internet that this gentleman is a very, very prolific author. I'll be back with more of Chris after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
This is OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Have you wondered how to change your love paradigm? The secret key is finding a love partnership, not just a regular connection. How do you find these? Through conscious relationships. Ascending Hearts Dating is a dating site for people like you that believes in second chances and a different type of spiritual connection. Try Ascending Hearts for free at ascendinghearts.com and change your love paradigm. Ascending Hearts, the premier dating community for the spiritually awake.
Hi, this is Julie Keigel.
And I'm Susan Schuler.
And I'm Lori Walker.
And we are
the Psychic Angel Channelers
from Angel Talk Tuesday.
Tune in every week at 10 a.m. Eastern on OmTimesRadio.com.
The angels have heard your call and are here to help.
Are you ready to receive?
Bathe in the beautiful vibrational frequency to help you heal, expand, and remember your magnificence with Angel Talk Tuesday.
What does Meals on Wheels do? They deliver meals and smiles to homebound seniors. But Meals on Wheels does something else. They turn a volunteer's lunch break into a meaningful experience.
As small and as simple as a relationship is between a volunteer and a client of Meals on Wheels, it's really so impactful. I never thought that 5 minutes could make so much difference in the lives of two people, but it has.
Drop off a warm meal and get more than you expect. Volunteer at AmericaLet'sDoLunch.org. That's AmericaLet'sDoLunch.org. Brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Christopher McIntosh. He's the author of Beyond the North Wind, The Fall and Rise of the Mystic North. Chris, are there comparable deities in other systems and belief systems and religions to Baldur and the other Norse deities?
Yes. For example, go back to Baldur, I believe that Baldur and the god Apollo are actually the same, because you only require a small sound shift to get from Baldur to Apollo, and both are figures of light, and I believe that both are in fact shamanic figures, but we can talk more about shamanism later. Apollo was said to come from Hyperborea and to spend half the year in Hyperborea and half the year in the south. So that's another reason why I think that the two are are probably identical. Odin, as I said, is in the Roman view, he corresponds to the god Mercury. Well, then there are various other gods. There's Thor, who's the thunder god. He's the god of force, and energy, and he has a hammer, which is like a thunderbolt. And in the Indian mythology, there's the god Indra, who is also a god of energy and force, and he has a thunderbolt. So I think he's probably the Indian counterpart of Thor. And of course, the Indian pantheon and the Nordic pantheon probably originally came from the same source, because it's all Indo-European. And the Indo-Europeans migrated outwards from some central point. We don't know exactly where, but somewhere in the region between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, and then went out in the direction of India and west in the direction of Europe and Scandinavia. So, and then, as I said, there's Loki, the trickster god, who has many, many parallels in other mythologies. So one can find many of these parallels.
And is there also, you had mentioned Loki with the devil, is there other parallels between the Norse deities and monotheism?
Well, I think only insofar as there were attempts after the Christianization, there were attempts to Christianize many of these accounts of the Nordic deities and Nordic mythology and the sagas. There were attempts to Christianize these, but basically, I think the answer is no. I think they're two very different things.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, the monotheistic worldview and the polytheistic worldview, such as in the Nordic mythology, are two very different types of worldview. So I don't really see any overlap there.
Now, I also learned from your book that what we know as Hel, H-E-L-L, was originally a Norse concept. What was their Hel, H-E-L, like?
Well, Hel, H-E-L, is both the name of the abode of the dead and the name of the goddess who rules over that abode. And it was originally, it was not a negative concept. And hell was not an evil place, and the goddess Hel was not an evil goddess. She was an earth goddess, and mostly quite benevolent. And in fact, there are places that are named after her. Holland, for example, is named after Hel, or Holla, as she's sometimes called. And there's a tree, in English it's the elder tree, in German it's Holunder, which is also named after Hel or Holla, and is considered a magical tree. So the connotation of Hel being a dark and negative place really came in with the Christianization. I mean, this is an example of what I was just saying about how the way that the Nordic mythology was presented was colored by the those who interpreted it in a Christian way, or chroniclers who were Christian.
What is the world tree, and what part did it play in Norse mythology?
Well, the symbol of a world tree occurs in many mythologies. It symbolizes the axis of the world, the axis mundi, And you get it, for example, you get a similar symbol in the Jewish Kabbalistic tree of life. And the Bodhi tree under which the Buddha obtained enlightenment. And there's an interesting example in Chinese tradition, the Tianmun tree, which has nine branches and nine roots, or nine roots and nine branches, which reach out to nine worlds. So it's very similar to the Yggdrasil, which also has incorporates nine worlds, and there may very well be a common source there. The tree is also important in shamanism, and it appears, for example, in the tent pole of the shaman's tent, which again becomes symbolic of the axis of the world, and what connects you with the world above.
You had mentioned the connection of Baldur and Apollo to shamanism. How so?
Well, Apollo is a rather shamanic figure, and Apollo's devotees went in for shamanic practices like shape-shifting, trance journeys, and so on. And one of his devotees was Pythagoras, the Greek geometrician, who is, you know, one of the key figures in Western thought. And there is evidence that Pythagoras and his followers were shamans. I could say more about.
Please, shamanism. Go ahead, please.
Shamanism is the religion of all the native indigenous peoples around the Arctic. So if you go from Greenland, around to Alaska, it's the Inuit, and then in Russia, northern Russia, and Lapland, there are again shamanic indigenous peoples, and then there's the Sami in northern Scandinavia. You could say that shamanism is really the original indigenous religion of the north, of the far north. And it actually pervades the Nordic mythology because, for example, the god Odin is described as having hung on the world tree, the Yggdrasil, for 9 days and nights to obtain the secret of the runes. And this is a typical shamanic ordeal. And Odin also has other shamanic characteristics. He has totem animals. He has two ravens and two wolves and a horse with eight legs. So, and he goes in for trance journeys and so on. So he's a very shamanic figure. It seems to me that shamanism underlies the Nordic mythology, at some point it ceased to be a living practice.
We had mentioned Stonehenge, or you had mentioned Stonehenge earlier in terms of archaeological finds. Is there any other archaeological evidence that the people of Hyperborea migrated south?
Yes. There've been some remarkable finds in Scotland in the form of some stone spheres about the size of a tennis ball, which are marked in such a way that they represent the so-called Platonic solids, that is the geometrical shapes that Plato believed to be the essential building blocks of the universe. And these are tetrahedron, cube, octahedron, dodecahedron, and icosahedron. But the interesting thing is these stone spheres are at least 1,000 years date from at least 1,000 years before Plato. So they obviously represent advanced knowledge. So where did this knowledge come from?
And also, you refer to findings of the golden mean and the Fibonacci sequence.
That's right. Yes, that's right. If you look at many of these prehistoric megalithic sites, they incorporate the golden mean. They also incorporate, according to the British archaeologist Alexander Thom, they include something called the megalithic yard. What he called the megalithic yard, which was a standard measurement, which is found all over, all over these megalithic remains, and this also presupposes quite an advanced level of civilization, because you would have to have some sort of matrix for this yard, which was shared throughout the whole of Northern Europe. So that again is another piece of evidence.
That is absolutely fascinating. My guest, Christopher McIntosh, he's the author of Beyond the North Wind, The Fall and Rise of the Mystic North. We'll be back with more of Chris after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Change and growth are part of natural life, and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the Om Times Experts program. With Om Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
Hey, hon, what you doing with your phone?
Do flowers have best friends?
I don't know.
Hey, look.
Whoa.
Some answers can only be found in nature. Discover the unsearchable. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a trail near you. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Christopher McIntosh. He's the author of Beyond the North Wind, The Fall and Rise of the Mystic North. Chris, what is the significance of the runic alphabet, and why has the reading of runes had a modern resurgence?
Well, the runic alphabet is a bit of a mystery. In fact, there are two main runic alphabets with some minor variations, but two main ones, or futharks, as they're called. There's the elder one, which dates from about the second century AD. And there's a younger one, the younger futhark, which came much later, around the eighth century AD. We don't know exactly where the letters came from. Some of them are similar to Roman letters. It's also thought possible that they're partly based on the Phoenician alphabet and partly on prehistoric cave markings, but we don't know precisely. But they spread very rapidly after they were invented, spread very rapidly over a large part of northern Europe. And it seems likely that they were invented by a group of people, because they're very systematic, they're very cleverly designed. So it seems likely that they were invented by a group of bards or elders, and then spread over this large area. What else can I say about them? They were used partly as an alphabet. You find them, for example, on many graves, in Scandinavia, as grave as a tribute on graves to the buried person. They're also used as a magical system. There are many references in the sagas to the use of the runes for magical purposes. And they're also used as a system of divination. Again, there are references to their use as a system of divination. Why do we have this resurgence? Well, again, I think it has something to do with the egregore that I was talking about earlier. The runes are a part of the egregore, and they have a special kind of energy. When you start working with them, it's an energy that is sort of like a strong wild type of energy, like an untamed horse. I could put it that way, but very vital and powerful.
In your book, you share a correspondence between runes and the Chinese Bagua system of divination. How was this discovered?
Well, this was discovered by a Norwegian friend of mine, Halvard Hafklau. He observed that the runes are basically made up of three types of stroke: vertical, left-leaning, and right-leaning. And he did an analysis, dividing the runes into different groups and counting the number of strokes in each group. It's difficult to explain what he did exactly, because it was extremely complicated. But through this analysis, he found that there was an exact correspondence with the Chinese Bagua system, which is similar to the I Ching, except it has trigrams instead of hexagrams. And yes, as I say, he found an exact correspondence. He arrived at groups of three runes each, which corresponded to the trigrams. And this is extremely interesting, because it suggests that both the Bagua system and the runes came from a common source.
A common source, or perhaps a common cultural understanding of the significance.
Yes, possibly, yes.
Now, in Beyond the North, you discuss resurgence in not only interest, but also the practice of the ancient northern religion. How has this manifested, in your opinion, and why?
Again, I think it's part of the egregore. As I said earlier, As Christianity has gradually lost its monopoly over the spiritual life of Europe and the West, people are looking around for other things, and some are turning back to the religion that corresponds to their own roots. So this revival, Iceland played a key role in it. It actually seems to have started simultaneously, both in Iceland and a number of other places. But Iceland really played a key role, and it was Iceland who gave it the name Asatru, which is now very widely used for the Nordic path. So how is it manifested? Well, if you're trying to revive a practice from 1,000 or more years ago, the question is how authentic can it be? Can it be linked directly with that earlier practice, or does it have to be a reconstruction? And I would say it's largely a reconstruction, but based on older sources and older traditions. So there is some continuity with the earlier practices. An example would be the use of the hammer of Thor, which is in a way the Nordic equivalent of the Christian cross. It's a sacred symbol in the Nordic tradition, and it's used, as among other things, as a ceremonial instrument, and as an instrument of consecration. And for example, it goes right back to prehistoric times, because there are cave paintings or etchings showing a figure holding a hammer over a couple who are obviously being married by this person with the hammer. So the Thor's hammer became, the hammer of Thor became an important symbol in a marriage ceremony. And at the marriage feast, after the ceremony, the hammer was placed in the lap of the bride. And this practice continued in some countries like Sweden until about the late 19th century or even later, and then went out of use. But now it's being revived.
So instead of the traditional shotgun wedding, they had the hammer wedding.
if you put it that way, yes.
You also say that this has had a resurgence in post-communist Russia.
Yes. Well, you know, this is something that interests me a great deal. I have two chapters in the book on Russia, and I find it fascinating what's going on in Russia right now, because the Russians are basically a nation of soul seekers. They've always been asking themselves what they believe in, what their role in the world is, and what values they should have, what is God or the gods, and so on. So, and this pervades so much of Russian culture. And after the fall of communism, this spiritual search has become intensified, and people are looking in different directions for, in a way, to find a spiritual direction. Some are looking to the Orthodox Church, which is once again flourishing. Some are nostalgic for the old communist days. Some are going for New Age things. And some are looking back to the pre-Christian past in Russia. And this is where the Hyperborean thing comes in, because there's a big school of thought in Russia which believes that Hyperborea was located in northern Russia, Russian Lapland, right up in the north, in the area of the White Sea and the Barents Sea. And there have been some archaeological expeditions to that region where they've discovered some very remarkable things, like ancient paved roads, pyramids, labyrinths, and a huge throne, twice human height, carved out of a single block of stone. So all these seem to point again to the existence of some precursor civilization up there in the north.
That's absolutely fascinating. What would you like readers to take away from Beyond the North Wind?
I think I would like to have given them a glimpse of the Nordic worldview and the Nordic mythology, which I find to be very rich and very inspiring and very beautiful. And it's something that it's not something that has to be restricted just to people of Northern European descent. It can be appreciated by anybody, anywhere in the world. And in fact, there are followers of the Nordic way in all over the world, from Latin America to the Middle East to the Far East, and so on. So I think everyone can get inspiration from this book.
My guest is Christopher McIntosh. He's the author of Beyond the North Wind, The Fall and Rise of the Mystic North. Chris, please tell our listeners one more time where they can get your book and find out more about your work.
They can get the book through any of the booksellers like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so on. And they can find out more about me by looking at my website, which is www.ozgard.net.
Chris, the book is absolutely fascinating. It's a rich read and truly eye-opening. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor, the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.